the last official Thursday night cheer for the season. And for those who remember once upon a time, like my father I see is here, and Shmuel and Dov Ber and others who usually attend the cheer in Bnei Yeshurun, it seems like a long time since we've had that tzchus of being together in shul together and being able to learn in person. I want to just thank Bnei Yeshurun. I want to thank the Adult Education Committee for allowing me to be a part of their weekly schedule throughout the year. Our Torah year, I guess, runs from the end of August until about now, and then we take a little break usually for the summer. So Baruch Hashem, most of the year we are learning together in person. And even though it seems like we've been doing this for a long time, I guess we have to remember all the times that we spent in the walls of Bnei Yeshurun. So I want to just thank the shul and the leadership for that opportunity. And Amir Tzashem, we'll take a break for a couple of weeks so I can find some new Torah to share with you. And Amir Tzashem, Elul time, we'll pick up once again. I want to begin tonight with a question, and I feel like all of the shiurim are rolled into one at this point. I feel like I'm speaking about the same things over and over again, just from different angles and different Mayer Makomos. But I guess we have to live with the times, we have to live with the Parsha. And these are the lessons that the Parsha is speaking to us, and this is what we're experiencing in the world. So I hope it's not redundant or repetitive in any way. But I want to just ask you the following question. How many of us remember what it was like back in February or March? You know, every time I go on Zooms, I click on an email that was sent to me by Rabbi Yosef Kalinsky, one of my bosses in YU, when he first, at the end of March, was introducing us to a platform called Zoom that I had never even heard of. And every time I go back to his email to click a certain link to get to my YU link to be able to host these Zoom meetings. It's amazing to watch with the passage of time and to think about life before all of this happened. And I want to ask you a question, and for those who have their screens on, I'll take a quick survey by a show of hands. How many people feel that time has been moving slower for the last 3.5 months? Okay, how many people think that time has been moving faster for the last couple of months? Okay, so we have a couple people on both sides of the fence, which is not surprising because if you ask people in general, you find that some people feel like time has completely slowed down, and it, you know, it feels like eternity every day just drags on. And for other people, they turn around and they say these, like, when I try to review what happened over the last couple of months, it feels like time flew by. And I guess the question that we need to think about is, why does that happen? How does that happen? Where does the warping of time take place when a person goes through a pandemic, I guess, to speak in our context? Now, what's amazing is that time is actually a very precise thing. So, for example, it takes 23.9 hours for the Earth to make one rotation on its axis. That's the metzias of time. But we don't experience it that way. We don't feel it that way. Our feeling of time and our sense of time is very different than that objective measure of 23.9 hours making up a day. So there was an interesting article that I saw recently written by a Dr. Philip Gabel. Dr. Gabel is an associate professor of psychology at Delaware University. And he explains that, and he spent the last 10 years studying the nature of time or our perception of time. And he says that there's a lot of truth to the expression, time flies when you're having fun. We've heard the expression before. Does time move faster when you're having a good time? Does time move slower when you're having a difficult time? But there's certainly a very real perception of that. And he explains, he uses the terms approach motivation and avoidance motivation. When you're enjoying something, when a person is engaged in some activity and they enjoy it, they want that experience to last. So what happens actually is that we experience what he calls, again, approach motivation, which means that our brain speeds up the process to make it less laborious. Because imagine, you have a project that you're working on and it's taking weeks to get it done. So just the schleppiness of that experience sometimes takes the joy and the life out of that experience. When you're enjoying something, your mind makes it move quickly, not because you want to get past it, but because there's a certain excitement that it's able to maintain. Your brain almost plays a trick on you to allow you to experience it in a way that's a little bit lighter and a little bit more fun, a little bit more enjoyable. You don't feel the weightiness of time dragging on. On the other hand, when a person goes through a difficulty, a person's mind allows one to experience, or causes one to experience, what he calls avoidance motivation, which is our perception of time slows down to the point that I feel almost stuck within that period of time that seems like it's never going to end. And because of that, I want to exit the situation. I want to find a way to somehow speed things up. So the body is responding by making it intentionally slow, and then I feel somewhat trapped and I want to get out of that. It's fascinating. That's why when people go through very, very tragic things, let's say, God forbid, a person gets into a car accident, so often people will describe that experience as having taken place very, very slowly. That experience that happened in literally a moment is felt or is perceived to be this long experience. And that's sort of some emotional way that the body is making the experience seem long and dragged out and therefore burdensome. And the human response is to want to escape from that situation. And Dr. Gable said, who has been studying this again for about 10 years, he said that when COVID arrived in the world, he started paying attention to people's perception of time. And what was interesting to note, and I think it's very true for probably many of us, is that while some people at the very beginning felt like time had completely slowed down, and we weren't quite sure what to do with ourselves, as our schedules and our lives radically shifted, he found that in interviewing people and in gathering information on people's experience, he found that for many people after those first couple of weeks, which were painfully slow, time started to fly by. And next thing you know, we've been doing this for months, and like, where did all of the time go? And he suggests, based again on his research, that as we got used to this new way of living, and it became part of our new routine, and we found other ways to make being at home meaningful or enjoyable and productive, so our perception of time began to shift. And we started to experience it more quickly, as one does when they're having fun. Time flies when you're having fun. Now, why am I sharing all of this with you? Because if you look in Parshas Korach, it's very interesting. The understanding of how Korach played with people's emotions, specifically as it relates to time, is fascinating. There's a discussion when exactly the story of Korach took place. Now, again, if we read the Torah just from beginning to end, if we read it in a linear fashion, so we learned about the Meraglim, and now we come to Korach. The first is Chet HaMeraglim, and then afterwards comes the rebellion of Korach. And there's a lot of reason to believe that. Rashi, in this week's Parsha, in Perek Tezayin Pasuk Dalet, Rashi says that there was a series of calamities that took place, of moments of rebellion against Hashem, time and time again where the Jews defied HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The third one was Chet HaMeraglim. The fourth one was Korach's rebellion. So that's how the Torah reads, that's how the Parsha reads. But the challenge to this, and what leads to a discussion amongst the Rishonim and the later authorities as well, is that if you look in the last Pasuk in Bahaloscha already, it says that the Jews traveled from a place called Chatzeros, and they came to Midbar Paran. Chatzeros to Midbar Paran. Rashi, at the beginning of Chumash Devarim, says Chatzeros was named for the Machlokas of Korach, and Midbar Paran is the place where the Meraglim took place. So they went from Chatzeros to Midbar Paran. Sounds like the story of Korach took place before the Meraglim. So is everyone clear on the question? On the one hand, you read the Torah, you read Parsha Shlach, and then Korach. You read about the Meraglim, and then you learn about Korach. But if you're paying attention to the locations and how Chazal understood the names of those locations and what they alluded to, the story of Chatzeros seems to be before Paran, which means that Korach seems to be before Chet HaMeraglim. So which is it? So there's a brilliant explanation that the Satmar Rebbe develops in his Divrei Yoel, Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Levracha. It's based in part on a comment of the Ramban. Think about Bnei Yisrael's experience when they first got to the Midbar. Right? Now on the one hand, we know that the Navi tells us, Lechtech Achar B'Midbar, Be'eretz Lo Zeruah. There was a lot of uncertainty that came with the Midbar. But there was a period of tremendous bliss that they experienced in the Midbar. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was providing them with the man. They saw unbelievable miracles under Moshe Rabbeinu's leadership. Things were pretty good. And even after Chet HaEgel, which was a terrible setback, but there was a sense that Moshe was still a popular leader and he was able to defend Klal Yisrael. And while Korach was probably already jealous of Moshe, no reason not to be, based on his claims in this week's Parsha, why does Moshe have so much power? It was probably brewing for a long time. But because everyone was having, so to speak, a good time in the Midbar, says the Satmar Rebbe, Korach may have been jealous, but there was nothing he could do about it then, because people were confident in Moshe Rabbeinu. But then came Chet HaMeraglim, and Korach saw as an opportunity after the Chet HaMeraglim, where Moshe Rabbeinu didn't really defend Klal Yisrael, perhaps as much as he did in other occasions, and now that they're destined to wait 40 years in the Midbar before going to Eretz Yisrael, all of a sudden time slowed down. So again, to use, you know, Dr. Gabel's Lashonos, along with the Satmar Rebbe, even though the two of them probably would have very little in common, right? There was this experience of what? This desire to avoid, to want to get out of the situation. Time was now slowed down to the point that we're stuck in the Midbar for 40 years. So the Satmar Rebbe says, so going back to our question, when was the rebellion of Korach? Was it before the Meraglim? Was it after the Meraglim? The Satmar Rebbe says, again, based in part on the Ramban, the idea was brewing for a long time. But it wasn't shayach for Korach to stage a rebellion before the Chet HaMeraglim. After the Chet HaMeraglim, it was dafka then that Korach was able to implement his plan. And the Satmar Rebbe explains that we have a klal in the Gemara that a person who has evil intentions, if they never come to fruition, Hashem is willing to forgo them. But when they come to fruition, HaKadosh Baruch Hu then holds you accountable for your evil intentions as well. So in a certain sense, retroactively, once Korach actually rebels, he's held accountable from even prior to Chet HaMeraglim. But again, to use Dr. Gabel's terminology, Korach took advantage of the people's avoidance motivation, that they were going through a difficult time, they knew they were stuck in the Midbar for a long time, and they wanted to get out of that situation. And the mistake of Korach and his followers, because it was a mistake, and this is the part that we all sometimes fall into, is that when we find ourselves in that situation and we want to change the situation, like some of us learned last night, those who were on the shir last night, perhaps a better way than trying to shift gears radically to try to avoid the situation is to find a new way to redefine that situation, to put a positive spin on this situation. And that's exactly what Dr. Gabel found, fascinatingly enough, about this period that we've all been experiencing for the last 3.5 months. That for many people, the beginning was torturous, and people would do anything to get out of it. And by now, as people are kind of getting back a little bit more to the regular routine, people have this nostalgic feeling for a period of quarantine. They like that life slowed down. For many people, they're upset to leave that behind. So that's what I want to talk about tonight for our final shiur of a year of Torah study together. Again, some people are joining us for the first time. Some have been learning with us throughout the year. But I want to talk about that experience of a fast life and slow life, of things that happen quickly and things that happen slowly. And as Dr. Gabel said, there's a real truism to the fact that time flies when you're having fun. And slow sometimes can be very painful. But the opposite is also true. Sometimes when things are going fast, when these months fly by and I look back and I say, what did I accomplish? The fact that it went by so quickly, I feel very frustrated by it. And sometimes when life slows down, actually, I appreciate slow. I enjoy slow. Slow is not always painful. It's not entirely true. So let's ask the question now from a perspective of Avodas Hashem. In Avodas Hashem, which way do we want to live as Jews? Do I want to live fast or do I want to live slow? Which is the better way to serve Hashem? Now, I'm sure there's a lot of examples we could think of in both categories. And that's appropriate to think of both being, you know, appropriate ways to serve Hashem, because fast and slow are both a part of our human experience. And again, that's what we're experiencing now. We've all experienced times in the last 3.5 months where we felt like things were really moving, weeks were just flying by, and we felt that there were times when everything was just schlepping along, and we couldn't wait for it to be over. There was a book that came out about 10 years ago. My mother bought it for me. It's a book, it was a New York Times international bestseller. It's called Thinking, comma, Fast and Slow. Anyone familiar with the book? Thinking, Fast and Slow. It's by an Israeli-American psychologist whose name is Daniel Kahneman. Obviously, he's Israeli, so his real name is Daniel Kahneman. I don't know if he's related to the Panovich or Rav. Had the name Kahneman as well. But he's a very well-known psychologist, and he wrote a lot about decision-making and behavioral economics. He actually won a Nobel Prize for some work that he did with another Yid in economics. Fascinating book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And as the title of the book sounds, he talks about two different systems by which we all operate. There's a part of us that operates really, really fast, And there's a part of us that rightfully so operates really, really slow. We have what he calls system one, which is fast and it's intuitive and it's emotional and it always wants to make that snap judgment. And then we have a part of ourselves, part of our psychology, part of our emotional and mental makeup is a second system, which is slow and it's more deliberative and it's methodical and it's more logical and it's more rational. And the book gives many examples of how in life we sometimes fall into the trap of either being too much of a system one type of person, a little too quick with my decision making, or I become a little bit too slow with my decision making, right? And we all spend our life trying to grapple with this balance of system one and system two. When can I trust my gut, make that snap decision, that quick decision? When is it a time to pause and to slow down a little bit? And again, it's so interesting. When you look in Parshas Korach, you see examples of quick and slow, and they're both right. They're both right. There's a place for both of them. We all live with these varying systems to varying degrees, and I want to show you a few examples in Parshas Korach, again, of how we see sort of that struggle, that grappling with time itself. I'll share with you an amazing insight from Michal Tursky, the Hornstipler Rebbe, the Rebbe from Milwaukee, Shlita. So Michal Tversky said the following about 10 years ago. He had the following insight. Korach and his entourage, they come to Moshe Rabbeinu. And they have their complaint against Moshe Rabbeinu. So Moshe proposes, okay, you know what we're going to do? We're going to do this interesting test. You have tainas against me, and you have tainas against Aaron. We're going to take this, we're going to take Ketores, and we're going to place it before Hashem. And whoever Hashem wants to choose, Hashem will choose. And Moshe says to Korach Va'adaso, when are we going to do this? When is this test going to take place? Boker v'yoda Hashem es asher lo. Tomorrow morning we're going to have a showdown, and Hashem's going to choose the one that is His. V'sakadosh v'yakriv elav. Okay, so let's wait till tomorrow. All right, fine. So they go home. Everyone goes home. They come back the next day for the Ketores showdown, and of course Aaron HaKohen is selected, and Moshe Rabbeinu is vindicated, and everything works out the way that you know we would hope that it works out. And Korach and his chevra find themselves in serious trouble. So Michal Tversky said, it's interesting. Now it's interesting that Moshe was able to convince Korach to come back the next day. Korach, you have such a passionate mission that you're fighting for here. You think that Moshe has usurped power in such a perverse way. And Moshe Rabbeinu, in a certain sense, was testing Korach to see how real he was. Explains the Hornstipler Rebbe, if you really care so much, Korach, you can't wait till the next day. Moshe was testing him. The fact that Korach was willing to wait till tomorrow was itself a proof that it wasn't being done l'shem Shemayim. Because if you really felt, Korach, that you were right, and you really felt that God was on your side, then you couldn't hold back one more day. You wouldn't be convinced to delay this. You would have accused Moshe Rabbeinu of delaying because he's playing games, because he has some trick up his sleeve. You would have forced Moshe Rabbeinu to settle matters right there and then on the spot. So from the fact that Moshe was able, says Rav Michal Tversky, from the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to convince Korach to wait, he was revealing the fact that Korach didn't live with a real sense of urgency with his own campaign. Which itself proved that Korach was a fraud. Because sometimes in life, if there's something that's really, really, really important to you, you just can't wait till the next day. It needs to happen right now. And Moshe was discrediting Korach, showing what a fraud he was, by showing, displaying before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, look, Korach's not for real. He's not as passionate. He talks a big game. But the fact that he's willing to sleep for one more night, if he's really correct, he should have fought for what he truly believed in right then and there. An amazing insight of sometimes a person has to operate with great zeal, with great passion, and with great speed. But the exact opposite could also be learned from the exact same pasuk. Because when Korach and his Eidah are arguing with Moshe, and Moshe says, Boker v'yoyda Hashem as asher lo, let's wait till tomorrow morning, Rashi says that Korach was... Maybe by then Korach will wake up and he'll realize that this is a machlokas that I don't want to get involved in. Maybe Korach will realize something. Maybe he's moving too quickly in his accusations of Moshe Rabbeinu. Just like a person sometimes, you know, you're so sure about yourself and you say, you know what, maybe I need to sleep on it. because maybe in the throes of passion, I'm making a bad judgment call. Maybe I need to gather a little bit more data to understand what's really happening here. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu tells Korach, you got to slow down. Dafki, you have to slow down, because if you rush, you're making a mistake. And even the next day, Korach unfortunately still didn't recognize the mistake. He still continued to rush, and he ended up making that terrible mistake. So amazing how you can look at the same pasuk. On the one hand, it's a critique of Korach for how could he sleep on it? How could he not act on it immediately if it was so important to him? And at the same time, Rashi reveals to us another lesson, that Korach was being told, maybe you need to slow down a little bit before you accuse Moshe and Aaron, two of the very fine tzaddikim of the generation, of usurping power without HaKadosh Baruch Hu's true authority. There's a story that's told of Ephraim Zalman Margolius. Ephraim Zalman Margolius was a great Galician Rav in the late 1700s, early 1800s, the author of the Mata Ephraim. So he said one time, his wife was holding a vase, and it slipped out of her hand, and it shattered to the floor, and she was hysterical, she was all upset. She was so upset, and he was totally calm. It was a very expensive vase. I guess it meant a lot to her. And she says to him, I don't understand, like, how could you be so relaxed? Like, you know, this beautiful vase was so costly, and it just, the whole thing is gone in a second. And he says to her, you know, he says, I can't tell you right now. You have to ask me in a year from now. A year from now? Yeah, I can't explain it to you now. I don't feel that I can explain it to you now. But in a year from now, I'll explain it to you. Okay. So she remembered it. It was important to her. She wanted to remember. So exactly a year later, she says to her husband, okay, you promised me in a year from now, you know, it's been a year to the day, since that beautiful vase broke. And I want you to explain, how were you able to be so calm when we experienced such a loss? So he says to her, tell me, does it still bother you now? So she says, you know what, so many things have happened over the course of the last year that I hardly even remember, you know, had I not reminded myself to ask you in a year from now, I would have forgotten about the incident completely. So he said to her, good. He said, so what you grasp now after a year, I was able to grasp immediately. And he said, and the reason your father chose me as his son-in-law, he said, because he saw that I was a genius. But what was my genius? My genius was that things that sometimes it takes people a year to grasp, I'm able to grasp in a moment. And I knew right then that in a year from now, it wasn't going to bother you, and therefore it didn't bother me right then in the moment. That's how I was able to maintain my cool in the moment. Right? Sometimes sometimes a person needs a lot of time to understand something which for another person comes very quickly, and vice versa. But that's the nature of these two systems that Professor Kahneman is describing in his book. And again, that's the balance we have to live with. Sometimes Moshe Rabbeinu was saying to Korach, if you really stand by this, if this is really that important to you, well then time flies when you're having fun, and time flies when you have an emistic point to make. And you should make that point. You should argue your point immediately, without any delay. But sometimes you need to sleep on it. Sometimes you need to slow down. Again, it's not a question of which system is more right or less right. They're both right, and they're both important in the life of a Jew. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, a couple of years ago, wrote an essay in Parshas Acher Emos. And he describes the two goats that, of course, we know from Yom Kippurim. Of course, that's described in Parshas Acher Emos. And he talks about the two goats, the Sarir La'Azazel and the Sarir La'Hashem. The Sarir La'Hashem and the Sarir La'Azazel, two goats, nearly identical in every aspect, as the Mishnah describes in Maseches Yoma. So alike in their appearance, and then totally different in their fate. We cast these two lotteries. One is LaHashem, one is LaAzazel. And on the one hand, on the surface, they're identical, and yet they go two different directions entirely. And Chazal are busy trying to figure out, what's the story with these two goats? What's the secret of these two goats? So if you look in the Midrash, when you look in the Zohar, and you look in the Mefarshim, like the Ramban and the Abarbanel, so many of our holy sources indicate that the imagery of the two goats, these identical goats, the idea that comes to mind immediately is twins. And when I start to think about twins, well, what better twins come to mind more than Yaakov and Esav? You can talk to my father who's here. I'll tell you about the nature of these twins. They were certainly not identical twins. They didn't look anything alike. Right? But there was a bond that they shared, obviously, in a very deep way. And again, my father has a lot of interesting Torah to share on that topic. But it's interesting. These two Se'irim, Right? Seir. Seir was the place that the Torah describes Esav as coming from. And we know that we take the Seir la'azazel, and as we send it off, we tie a red string to its horns, which we then attach to a cliff, and we throw it off the cliff. We hope that the red will turn white, the red which is Edom. Again, another name for Esav. And of course, the Shnei Seirei Izim, as the Torah describes it, in Parshas Achrimos, is very much reminiscent of the Shnei Gidiei Izim, that Rivka tells Yaakov to take as he's preparing to get the bracha from Yitzchak back in Bereishis, Perach Chav Zayin. So asks Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, so who are Yaakov and Esav? What's the difference between them? So we could be simple about it. We could say, well, one's a good guy, one's a bad guy. One's a tzaddik, one's a rasha. But Rabbi Sacks, Kedarko B'Kodesh, says that it's much more nuanced than that. Esav's not just, you can't just throw Esav out and say he's just a rasha. Because after all, his father loved him. And his father, Yitzchak Avinu, wanted to give him the bracha. And Esav, Chazal, see Esav as the greatest, maybe ever, in Kibud Av, in honoring his father. On the one hand, he's a bit deceptive with his speech, but on a certain level, he's the greatest. There's a lesson to be learned from him. Moshe Rabbeinu tells us in Devarim Perach Chav Gimel, that don't forget, don't despise someone from Edom. After all, he is your brother. And as different as Yaakov and Esav are, we can't just say that Esav is just a simple Rasha. Even though on a certain level, Chazal say that about Esav. So how else can we understand the difference between Yaakov and Esav? These two twins, which again are embodied by these twin goats of Yom Kippur. So Rabbi Sacks says that the problem with Esav, and the thing that sets him apart from Yaakov Avinu, is that Esav is a person who is defined by his impulse. Esav is a person who's always moving too quickly. He's too quick to sell his birthright. He comes in one day, he's hungry, and immediately, in a moment of passion, of misguided passion, right? I'm so hungry. Some of your firstborn rights, right? Now, the fact that Yaakov would even think to ask for something that he's only going to cash in on so many years later, that was something, it shows you that he's a person of perspective. And Esav sees the bowl of soup right in front of him, and in an impulsive way, he says, I want the soup. And he eats it, and he gobbles it down. And it's interesting, and if you look at the terms that are used there in the psukim, it sounds like almost staccato, the way that it's just like, Esav, he ate, he drank, he rose, he left, he despised, Vayivas, Esav, Esabachora, it's he did this, he did that. It's very choppy. It's a person who's just very impulsive in the way that he's acting. And that was the nature of Esav. Whether it was his hunger, or whether it's his desire to kill as a hunter, he was a person who was too quick to act. And Yaakov is the exact opposite. Yaakov, even though Yaakov is also an emotional person, but Yaakov knows how to think long term. Yaakov knows how to slow down. Yaakov knows how to appreciate the slowness of life, which again, some of us have learned to appreciate over the course of the last couple of months. Again, he has the perspective to buy the birthright of Esav, which is something that, again, won't really offer him much for probably a very long time. And he's willing to work for 7 years for his beloved Rachel. And he's willing to listen to the brothers lamenting the fact that Yosef has these crazy dreams, and on the one hand, on the surface, he rebukes Yosef. What does the pasuk say? Va'aviv shamaras hadavar. Yaakov Avinu was patient. He says, let's see what comes of Yosef's dreams. He stored it away in his heart. He never acts impulsively. And he thinks long and hard before making his decisions. And that's why Yaakov, when he's on his deathbed, he looks at some of his children who are a little too fast, which is probably how many of us look at our children, those of us who are blessed with children, as the generations seem to get faster and faster and faster, and everything in the world just goes faster and faster. And Yaakov looks at his own children and he says, Reuven, you're unstable like water. You acted too quickly when you moved the beds. Shimon and Levi, you were a little too quick, a little too impulsive. Your anger to destroy the city of Shechem. What happened there? It was a little too quick. You're a little too emotional. You need to balance system one with system two. There's a time to be fast, and there's a time to be quick, but there's also a time to be deliberate, and there's a time to slow down. And therefore, when we come to Yom Kippur, and Rabbi Sacks writes it so beautifully, you should look it up. It's from Achrimos 5779. He quotes from the book that I mentioned earlier, Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And he talks about these two tracks. And he talks about how as human beings, we're blessed with the second track. Animals don't have the second track. animals, for the most part, operate based on impulse, based on drive, based on whatever they see before them. That's the world of Esau. That's not the world of Yaakov. The world of Yaakov is being able to slow down and to appreciate slowing down. Right? Yes, what Rav Michal Tversky said is true. If Korach was correct, he should have fought for it right then and there on the spot. He shouldn't have been able to sleep on it for even a night. But at the same time, what Rashi says is also equally true. That Korach also needed to go to sleep and needed to slow down a little bit to understand that he's about to challenge Moshe Rabbeinu, the one who went up to Har Sinai and brought down the Torah to Klal Yisrael. The humble Moshe Rabbeinu was not usurping power for himself without HaKadosh Baruch Hu's permission. And therefore, says Rabbi Sachs, when we show up on Yom HaKippurim and we have these two goats, it's very reminiscent of the way that Yitzchak says to Yaakov, HaKol kol Yaakov v'yadai midei Esav. Isn't that interesting? That in that moment where Yaakov becomes, so to speak, Yaakov Avinu, when he gets the firstborn blessings from his father Yitzchak and becomes that line from Avram Yitzchak Yaakov, isn't it interesting that at that moment he's a combination of Esav and Yaakov? HaKol kol Yaakov v'yadai midei Esav. In other words, Yitzchak recognizes in him there's going to be a little bit of both in every person. That's the metzias of human beings. But at the end of the day, who do you want to be? Do you want to be a Sayer La Hashem, or do you want to be a Sayer La Azazel? Do you want to be that world of Esav, or do you want to be the world of Yaakov? Do you want to be someone who throws away his life for a bowl of soup? Or do you want to be a person who has a little vision, a little perspective, is able to look out into the future? The truth is, the end of the story of Korach actually is a beautiful one, because the Arizal reveals to us an amazing thing. Tzadik katamar yifrach, the Arizal explains that tzadik katamar yifrach, tzadik ends with the letter kuf, katamar ends with the letter resh, yifrach ends with the letter ches. Sofei tevo, tzadik katamar yifrach, a tzadik will sprout like a tamar, is a reference to Korach, right? Tzadik katamar yifrach, the last three letters spell out Korach. That is to say that just like the date palm, right, eventually, you know, blossoms and flourishes, so too Korach also. There's a truth to Korach's perspective. When Korach says, Va'amech kulam tzadikim, there's a truth to that. There's a Balaturim, I think it's in Parshasra, that says in the future we're all going to be Kohanim, or maybe we're all even going to be Kohanim Gedolim, whatever that is. But Korach is right, in a certain sense. Every Jew is, right? We're all tzadikim, we're all kedoshim. Moshe Rabbeinu, why do you set your heart? But the way that Korach said it was premature. It wasn't thought through enough. And the way that he issued his complaint against Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't justified. And therefore, Rabbi Sachs says again, on the most important day of the year, Yom HaKippurim, we ask ourselves, who do I want to be? Am I an impulsive Jew? Am I a thoughtful Jew? Am I a Jew who's owing for the quick and the fast, which again, is sometimes a very meaningful and positive experience, and slow can be sometimes so painful and torturous, but at the same time, do I learn to appreciate slow? Do I understand what it means to slow down? Today was Gimel Tammuz, as Doug mentioned at the beginning, right before we started this year. Gimel Tammuz, of course, is the yard site of the Lubavitch Rebbe. I spoke last night, I shared a few stories from the Lubavitch Rebbe. Gimel Tammuz, the 26th yard site of the Lubavitch Rebbe. But tonight I want to tell a story from one of the other tzaddikim of Chabad, and that is the Rebbe Rashab. I heard from Rabbi Shmuel Braun a beautiful little story a couple of years ago. He said that the Rebbe Rashab, when he used to give over his long ma'amarim in Chassidus, so there was a special niggin, a special tune that they used to sing as an introduction to saying over the mimer. And there was one occasion where Chassidim were singing this niggin, this special niggin of Dveikus, or whatever it was that they would sing, this niggin to prepare them to listen to the tzad to give this long Torah discourse. And the Rebbe Rashab noticed that the people were singing very quickly. They were like rushing through the niggin. Why? Because the Rebbe Rashab was such a genius in Torah, his words were so sweet and so deep and so profound that everyone just wanted to get to the Torah already. But the tradition of Chabad was you had to sing this niggin before you got to the, you know, before you got to the Torah, before you got to the Mimer. But the Chevra there, the Chassidim were so eager that they were singing it at some crazy tempo. So the Rebbe Rashab stopped them and he said, that's not how you sing the niggin. You don't rush through the niggin just to get to the mimer that comes afterwards. That's not, he said, a pnimi, and the Lubavitch Rebbe, you know, again on his yard site, spoke a lot about this in 1991 in Parshas Pinchas. Lubavitch Rebbe told this story and spoke about this story and extracted lessons from this story. But the Rebbe Rashab, the fifth Lubavitch Rebbe, said, a pnimi, a person who's a pnimi is a dika person. A person who's really a person who's a balanced person, a person who's an inward-turned person, a person who understands how to live life, that there's a time for fast and there's a time for slow, understands that the niggun has to be the niggun and the mimer has to be the mimer. And those two worlds each have to have their own place. And I have to be fully present for the niggun. I can't be thinking about what comes next when I've experienced this right now. And again, that's part of the challenge we've all been going through. On the one hand, we all want to just get to what's next. We're all wondering when we're going to get to kind of that next stage. I can't tell you how many conversations every day, every week. I'm so tired of the conversations. Not that I don't think they're important, but I'm so tired of trying to figure out when are we going to do like this, when are we going to do like that. People want to know what's this, when's this happening, when's that happening, on a communal level, on a personal level, who's doing this, who's doing that. It's very cumbersome. But that desire to move forward is a holy thing. And the ability to be, like the Rebbe Rashab said, to be a pnimi, to be a person who's present where he is, who's singing the niggun now, and we'll get to the mimer when we get to the mimer. I'll just conclude, as we enter into these parashios, and continue to learn the parashios of Klal Yisrael's experience in the Midbar. Again, like Korach took advantage of that moment of the Jewish people after the Chet Meraglim, being sentenced to 40 years of being stuck in the Midbar. And we're going to read in the coming parashas about the travels, continuing to learn about the travels of Bnei Yisrael. How they went from this place to that place as we end the end of Chumash Bamidbar. And since we're not going to have shir for the next couple of weeks, I'll give you something to think about. The Ragach of Ergon, the Tzafnas Paneach, in Parashas Maaseh, he asks the following question. And think about this as we part ways. Again, I don't know if these weeks apart will feel quick for you, it'll feel slow for you, it'll feel long for you. I don't know. I have a feeling I'm going to miss everyone very much, but I look forward to getting back to the Shirim in a couple of weeks, and hopefully I'll have some new Torah to share by then. But the Ragachavar said the following. The Ragachavar said that when a person brings a karbon, there are four steps, there are four critical steps to the processing of a karbon. We shech the animal, we receive the blood, Kabbalah, then holacha, we transport the blood to the Mizbeach, and then, of course, what's the moment of atonement? The sprinkling of the blood, the Zrika. Again, Shechita, Kabbalah, Holacha, and Zrika. So what's interesting is that Chazal tell us that each of those steps has the potential, with a wrong machshava, to damage the karbon. A machshava is pigul, if I intend to eat the karbon beyond its time or out of its proper place, we call that pigul, different halachos, depending on the type of wrong machshava. But I can damage the karbon if I have the wrong intention while I'm slaughtering. I can damage the karbon if I have the wrong intention when I'm receiving. I can damage the karbon while I'm transporting the blood or while I'm sprinkling the blood. So the Ragach of Ergon said, I don't understand. Holacha, transporting the blood, that's a step? That's not really a step in the karbon. I mean, think about it. If we were to shecht it closer to the corner of the Mizbeach, so then I wouldn't have to walk it over to the Mizbeach. I mean, that's not really like part of the karbon. Shechting it is part of the karbon. Receiving the blood is part of the karbon. Sprinkling it is the main moment of the atonement. Why is holacha, why is the intention that a person has during holacha an integral part of the karbon? And the Ragach Shavar said that from the halacha we see that yes, the holacha is also the way that a person travels, the way that a person takes those steps, right? Whether I'm moving too quickly or I'm moving too slowly, and again, it's a balance that we're always grappling with. We're living within these two systems. Korach was in some ways right, and he was some ways wrong, and eventually he's going to be right. Tzadika Tamar Yefrach. They're both true, and they're all true, and it's our job to try to work it out. But what the Ragach of Ergon tells us is that holacha matters also. Holacha is a critical step in the experience. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu should help us to figure out this balance. Again, so much of Yiddishkeit is just a balancing act. It's figuring out how to be a balanced Jew. I once read in the Sefer, someone asked a certain Rav, is Judaism an extreme religion? And the Rav said, absolutely. Hashem wants us to be extremely balanced. I love that line. It's a beautiful line. We have to be extremely, extremely balanced. We have to be extremely thoughtful about when do we move fast, when do we move slow, when do we work with a sense of urgency, when do we have patience. Again, we're experiencing it now. We have been experiencing it. And again, think back to that study that I shared with you at the beginning. And again, how Korach on the one end was plotting his rebellion from before, and he waited for that moment when life slowed down to try to push people into into a radical shift, the rebellion against Moshe as part of their avoidance motivation. But that's not always the best way to be. And again, like we've learned from this process of being able to appreciate the slowness of life, I could tell you for myself, even though in some ways things are busier than ever and more chaotic than ever, and I feel like my life is less scheduled than ever, but in a certain sense, some of the noise of life has slowed down quite a bit. And it's important for us to learn to embrace that. So Mirtz Hashem, we should strike that balance in the right way. We should learn to be present, like the Rebbe Rashab said, to be in the niggun when we're in the niggun, and learning Torah when we're learning Torah. We should know that there's a time and a place, like Rav Michal Tversky said, not to sleep on it, because if you've got the right idea, act on it right away. But like Rashi said, there's a time to sleep on it, to make sure that you're not wrongfully challenging Moshe Rabbeinu's authority. So Hashem should help us again, as we take these next steps, as we travel through the end of Chumash Bamidbar, and we read about Klal Yisrael's travels. Let's think that Halacha also matters. The way that we travel. When do we go fast? When do we slow down? Hashem should help us to strike that balance in the right way. Everyone should have a great Shabbos. Thank you very, very much for learning with me. And Amir Tz Hashem, we'll be in touch. Look forward to continuing in a couple of weeks from now.